Good morning, Nexus. So science is at it again. We now know that tears can help us enjoy our snacks even more. That's my takeaway, anyway. From a recent study that says when folks are already a little blue and we watch something emotional, whether it's happy or sad, it reduces our capacity to taste fat in food. So when we're upset and turn to Netflix, an emotional scene confuses our taste perceptions. These emotions are perceived as a kind of stress in the body, and our survival instincts kick in. So our ability to detect bitter, sweet and sour increases by 15%, but our ability to taste fat, which is the real enjoyment factor, drops dramatically. So my conclusion is, if we want our buttered popcorn or ice cream to taste better, we should have a little cry first, release all those tears so that unexpressed sadness doesn't turn down the tastiness of our favorite treat. And there are good things to being sad. Researcher Brené Brown tells us sad people are less prone to judgmental errors, more resistant to eyewitness distortions. They're more sensitive to social norms, and are sometimes more motivated and generous. But how do we feel about crying, about sadness? So one of the things I love about Nexus is that we don't shy away from good questions or big feelings like sadness. I hear you did a sadness fire at Brad's a few years ago. And at the end of May, we're actually taking some more time to reflect on the effects of COVID, to acknowledge and grieve our losses. Such good stuff. But on the whole, wouldn't you say the larger culture generally moves away from sadness or stuffs it down somehow? So we may not be getting a lot of support in knowing what to do with our sadness. Yet as people on the Jesus path, we probably know this remarkable verse in John 11. Jesus wept. Two words. Can you imagine the scene? His dear friends Mary and Martha are weeping, sobbing over the death of their brother, Jesus' friend Lazarus. Martha has scolded him for not getting there in time. People are gathered around and they're ready to bring Jesus to the grave of his friend. He breaks down. I was talking with a friend recently who actually just preached on this story, and she asked her congregation, what if the text said Jesus burst into tears? How does that impact the way we see Jesus or the way we view tears? Jesus shows us how to be authentically human, so becoming whole, emotionally available people, and he calls us to make room for sadness. There are many things that can only be seen through eyes that have cried. So as I make this case for sadness this morning, I won't be able to address the experience and work necessary after major losses and trauma, but I'm hoping in general to encourage us to move towards our difficult emotions. Make room for sadness. Express it, feel it, cry our tears instead of exiling them to a remote inner island. Lots of us can be quite allergic to sadness, but just like all emotions, sadness has gifts for us. Wholehearted living includes whole, grounded people have good access to all our emotions, even sadness. So for me, finding and feeling sadness is not really a stretch. It's more like my default setting. When I was a child, perhaps still, I liked the feeling of tears. I think I was about 6, and I told my Nana I liked crying. She said, no, you don't. But I did, and I cried a lot. And actually, so did she, now that I think about it. Nothing like a good cry. So you may not relate. The lens of my personality just tends to automatically focus on the sad, the bittersweet, the tragic, what is missing. Oh my, the Rahner quote Brad used on Easter Sunday, in the torment of the insufficiency of everything attainable, we come to understand that here in this life, all symphonies remain unfinished. Oh. After an event, I have found myself regularly combing through my recollections to see if there's anything to sigh over. This may be a little weird, but I notice just a tiny bit of disappointment when I can't find anything because it was just so good. I think there's a part of me that enjoys playing the unfinished symphonies of the evening, tying it into the unfinished symphony of my life. Any good moments are all the more tragic because of their temporality. So my natural wiring means that, especially in the past, I didn't really value the good. I didn't know I could hold on to the simple beauty in moments. I just naturally notice what's missing, how it didn't compare to last time. So why would I do that? Because as much as I enjoy the tragic, in some ways, I do like joy better. But I just have this feeling that it's not as valid or attainable or reliable or lasting. So the Enneagram tells me that because of my lens, the conclusion I made in childhood is that it's not okay to be happy. And we all have these it's not okay beliefs. I remember a moment for me when mine really took root. I was 12. It was after dinner. Our family of five was still sitting around our tiny little drop leaf kitchen table. We were laughing and talking. Probably I was telling knock-knock jokes or just teasing my older sisters. In any case, we were being really silly, bantering back and forth, noisy, just enjoying one another. The phone rang, and my mom answered it, laughing her hello. We all tried to quiet down, and we did, in a hurry. Because the next sound from my mother was kind of a strangled sob, which I cannot replicate. Oh, I'm sorry. It was awful news. My uncle calling to tell us of the sudden and unexpected death of my aunt came out of nowhere. That moment, that fall, when joy turned to sorrow, when laughter turned to tears, felt unbearable to me. Looking back, I think there was even shame there that I had been happy when someone else was so incredibly sad. So my young self made a kind of inner decision that sorrow would not find me laughing. I would wait, and I would watch. I would be sad, and I would be ready. It didn't really make me ready, though. It just made me sad. So you may be wired like me to keep sadness too close. Your natural tendency might be to keep it too far, to deny it and push it away from you. And this is actually familiar territory for me as well, because sadness came too close when I went through a really serious depression. So I can also overcorrect and push it away. Nope, we are not doing that again. More recently, I feel sadness inviting me to make more room. Perhaps that's the big reason for this sermon. I'm noticing as I make room for sadness in my joy, the joy feels stronger and less fragile. My heart feels stronger, more available to hear God, to see people. For folks who keep their sadness far away, may it be that you fear your sadness will overwhelm you? I know sometimes really seems like it could. But if I may be bold enough to speak on behalf of your sadness, I bet it doesn't want to overwhelm you. I bet it just wants to be acknowledged. Yes, I feel sad sometimes. This is sad. When we give sadness some space, it can stop working so hard to get our attention, and it can relax, becoming a helpful companion, a good friend. Look at this puppy. All he needs is a little cuddle, a little scratch behind the ears. Maybe sadness is the same. It'll settle down. Again, I think we're speaking about the regular ups and downs of life. Grief and trauma work is on a different scale. But this gentle moving towards befriending our difficult emotions is part of that picture too. So what if we put it like this? We don't want to swallow our sadness, stuff it down. We don't want to wallow in our sadness and drown in it. What if we simply allow it? So you may be saying, oh, why would I willingly head towards those uncomfortable places inside me, you know, besides better tasting snacks? Very compelling reason, admittedly. Why would I want to befriend my sadness? I'd mostly really rather not. Sadness will make its presence known. It's just a question of when, where, and how. And like all of our emotions, sadness actually grows when swept aside. The more extreme it becomes, the more it can lead us into danger. Numbing activities need to get more and more serious, causing a greater need for numbing. It can be tempting to just keep running from it all as it feels more and more awful, but at some point, we have to just stop and welcome and allow our feelings, turning towards these parts of us with love and compassion. I believe Peter Scazzaro is right. He says that our spiritual health is connected to and can never surpass our emotional health. Our spiritual health cannot surpass our emotional health. So when we tend to our emotional life, it frees us spiritually more and more. I think we are learning to combine the wisdom of our hearts and minds with our spirits. A resource I really appreciate is a book by Allison Cook and Kimberly Miller called Boundaries for the Soul that weaves together spirituality with psychology, and they speak to church folk in a really familiar language, unpacking some unhelpful, toxic ways we've been taught to view our emotions. They encourage heading towards them in order to develop a good distance from them. So think about the closeness and farthest of your sadness. If it's too close, they say, you might experience self-pity, loneliness, depression. That's when we're wallowing. Sadness is too close. But when sadness is too far, so we're unaware of it, we're in denial, that's when we're swallowing it or stuffing it down. Anger might actually step in to protect us to keep that sadness at bay. It's often much more comfortable to feel angry than to feel sad, because sad just feels so weak. Sometimes to notice and acknowledge the sadness that's fighting for attention, we need to first acknowledge the anger and actually ask it to step back. Thank you. Give us some room to listen to our sadness. When we befriend our sadness, it opens us up to ourselves, which brings freedom and so many other gifts. Cook and Miller list quite a few benefits. Getting in touch with our sadness means we're better able to tell our stories, and that helps us connect with others, and it grounds us in reality. We come to understand our hearts and the things we love, and that gets us in touch with our motivations, what makes us tick. And then we can get in touch with our inner fire. When we're passionate about something, we have energy for it, we come alive. Sadness helps us feel connected with what it means to be human. It reminds us of our inextricable connection to one another, moving the individual us toward the collective us. And sadness can connect us with our need for others and for God. You know, my anthem in high school was, I am a rock, I am an island, and a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. Ironically, singing that song made me cry. And it's not true either. Rocks just live half their lives, and they are very lonely. Opening ourselves to the very human need for others and for God is a key to living more fully and connected. We grow in empathy. We learn how to come alongside others who are suffering. And we notice when we have personal losses or burdens that need some attention. That helps us be healthy and grow. I am learning to sit with my feelings without wallowing or analyzing them, which is another trick I have. Just feeling them. And they pass through, leaving me a little richer and wiser. Something that I'll add to their list is that I'm noticing I'm enjoying other people's successes and joys so incredibly much. Others' good news is just delicious to me in ways that it wasn't before. The truth is, Brené Brown tells us, sadness moves us, and being moved actually leads us to enjoyment. When we move towards the uncomfortable places, we'll find when we're right in them, they're not as bad as we thought when we were holding ourselves up out of them. And actually, there are other lovely things present as well. So yes, I feel sad, and there is joy, too, in my life. So wherever our sadness is, whether it's too close or too far, it needs our care to bring it to a good distance. How do we care for our sadness? Cook and Miller invite us to become curious about it. listen to it, and befriend it with the help of our spirit-led selves. That's what they call it. It's the part of us deep in our core that knows we are rooted and grounded in love, connected to God, connected to others, to ourselves. This is the place of deep compassion, creativity, curiosity, connection, clarity, confidence. This is where great ideas come from, where our generosity comes from. It's there in all of us. By definition, this part cannot be harmed. It can only be obscured or ignored. So to care for our sadness, we use this place and create a safe space to grieve and be sad. And that is a safe space outside of you and inside. So outside of you, this is your physical environment, the people around you. So get counseling, cultivate friendships and spaces where you can share and be seen as you are. Leave margins of time between emotionally fraught things so you can shake it out. It's one of my favorites, cry. Scream, punch a pillow, do something creative. Do something physical. I have prayer activities for processing your feelings with God. Let me know. Pro tip here, do not try to cry on your back. You'll get tears in your ears. It's just too difficult to, like, generate the tears. Even on your side, it's really hard to get those belly sobs out. So at the very least, if you're in bed, it's a great place to cry. Roll over onto your tummy. Even better, get on your knees, fetal position, blanket around you, just sob into that pillow. Or, this is kind of next level, try moving around, standing. Whatever helps things flow, you know? Body movement helps release and move the feelings that get stored inside us. For a safe place inside you, it really does help to do this intentionally with God. I can be really hard on myself, but when I intentionally review the day with God, this is called the prayer of Examen, I'm slightly allergic, I notice a lot of inner resistance toward it. But when I do it, God won't let me beat myself up. It's just not the same. There's a perspective and wisdom, a sense of compassion, causes me to look at my day, my life, myself, in a much more positive, mature, compassionate sort of way. So we just be kind and gentle with our sadness. We honor it by acknowledging the hurt of the loss we experienced. Being unkind is telling ourselves we're stupid for caring about something that seems so little. It's just not helpful. I don't always appreciate the sad part of me. She shows up at inconvenient times, but I'm learning to be kind, to take her seriously, and listen. So validating our sadness means acknowledging it, allowing it to be. I think it's often a bit of an elephant in the room. Maybe we're afraid if we acknowledge the presence of sadness, it's like opening Pandora's box and we'll release all kinds of evil into the world. We tend to have pretty major resistance towards validating emotions in others. Just notice your reaction if someone, like your friend, your child, your spouse, says they're feeling sad. My guess is the first thing you do is argue back. Oh, sweetie, no, you don't need to feel like that. It's gentle, maybe, but it's not validating. Validating is more like, yeah, it's really sad. I'd be sad, too. But we worry, don't we? If we validate someone's big emotions, they'll just double down into them and we'll lose them in a kind of emotional quicksand. Generally, I've found the opposite to be true, because what happens is the worried part inside of us, having all the big feelings, is so relieved that someone is finally reasonable enough to see the problem too, they can calm down. Okay, you're on it. It takes the air out of the big feelings balloon. I'd like to make a public service announcement here. There's no such thing as a valid or invalid emotion. Emotions just are. They are attached to something. An overreaction is usually about something else, something tender. And an overreaction just might be our feelings rebelling after being shoved down one too many times. Either way, let's give them a listen. So the fourth thing is we want to establish a gentle boundary. Remember, good fences make good neighbors. Good boundaries, good friends. Embracing our emotions with good boundaries allows them to take their rightful place in our lives and quit being so overbearing and uncomfortable. Let me give you an example for this one. Just recently, I could feel I had a buildup of tears that needed to be released. For me, it feels like a sigh or a yawn that just never comes. It can feel like tightness in my throat or in my chest. I also notice, usually, a lot of resistance to facing those tears. I'm fine. Do a lot of organizing. But I'm always glad when I do face them and let them out. So I'm not entirely sure what it was all about. Probably the usual overwhelm of feeling I'm failing everyone I know and love. Maybe the news or the past or the future. The torment of the insufficiency of everything attainable. You know, the usual. I didn't have time that morning to ask my tears where they came from or journal for hours. I needed to put some limits on my sadness. So I gave myself a few minutes. I found my safe space and I gave it a good go. Pretty sure I was on my yoga mat crying and praying and crying. And I didn't have a particular sense of a response or a beam of light or warm fuzzies, but I just trusted that I had been heard and I jumped into the shower and got on with my day. Expressing my sadness didn't mean it took over my life. The opposite is true. If I hadn't let it out, it just would have made everything I did that day so very hard and heavy. Instead, I briefly acknowledged it, gave it to God, and kept my commitments for the day. And later when I had more time, it took a while, but I had this sermon coming up, so I had to, I returned to the feelings to see if they had more to say to me. And when the volume was turned down a little bit, I could hear a lot better. When I journaled, I heard some very tender desires. I was able to write a list of things I'm hoping for, which feels really dangerous and scary to me, but such a good thing to do. I've got another example of setting an inner boundary with God's help. I have permission to share this story. One of my spiritual direction clients was struggling with anxiety. In the course of a session, we imagined what her anxiety was like and what it was up to inside of her. She imagined her life like a kind of ship on the sea. She realized that anxiety was at the helm. As we invited God to guide us, we gave anxiety some space, gave her a listen. Her anxiety realized it was out of place. And Jesus took the wheel. Anxiety, though, climbed up into the crow's nest where it could point out potential dangers without steering the ship because it would never willingly head to the places her ship needs to go. And anxiety calmed down because it had found its place. It had a job. It had a role. So sadness, fear, joy, hope, all our feelings are there for our good. And ultimately, sadness needs and wants to find its rightful place inside us, becoming a companion we don't need to fear. Sadness belongs in the human experience. So how do we do this practically? Lots of us turn to music, like the songs Dave and the band played for us this morning. Those are great ones. Let the songwriter speak for us. Historically, people of God have turned to the Psalms, writing them, singing them. The Psalms express a huge range of emotions, sometimes within one. We are called to see and feel with the psalmists, to join our prayers with them, mingling praise and lament. Sometimes we sing, sometimes we cry. Of the 150 psalms, 30 are classified as psalms of complaint or lament. Most of them turn to praise at the end, but Psalm 88 is the only one that doesn't. It ends, "You have taken my companions and loved ones from me. The darkness is my closest friend." Lamenting is a spiritual practice. It's so faithful, and lots of us worry it isn't. But why wouldn't it be faithful to trust God with what we're actually feeling? God is not afraid or upset by our sadness. In their book, Reconciling All Things, Emmanuel Kadungole and Chris Rice teach us about lament. They say, "Lament is the cry of the psalmist of Israel in exile, who, feeling abandoned by God, demanded, 'Where are you, Lord?' Or the psalmists who were bothered by God's remarkably bad sense of timing. 'Why are you taking so long?' The poor are being crushed. The wicked are winning. Don't you see it?" But lament is not despair. It is not whining. It's not a cry into the void. Lament is a cry directed to God. It's the cry of those who see the truth of the world's deep wounds and the cost of seeking peace. It is the prayer of those who are deeply disturbed by the way things are. Lament refuses to spiritualize, explain away, ignore, or deny the depth and truth of suffering in this world. Lament is a protest against the world as it is and the brokenness that seems so inevitable. So listen to Psalm 13, the Passion Translation. I'm hurting, Lord. Will you forget me forever? How much longer, Lord? Will you look the other way when I'm in need? How much longer must I cling to this constant grief? I've endured this shaking of my soul, so how much longer will my enemy have the upper hand? It's been long enough. Take a good look at me, God, and answer me. Breathe your life into my spirit. Bring light to my eyes in this pitch black darkness, or I will sleep the sleep of death. Don't let my enemies proclaim I've prevailed over him, for all my adversaries will celebrate when I fall. Lord, I have always trusted in your kindness, so answer me. I will yet celebrate with passion and joy when your salvation lifts me up. I will sing my song of joy to you, the Most High, for in all of this, you have strengthened my soul. My enemies say I have no savior, but I know I have one in you. It doesn't need to take hours. We simply express our true feelings to the one who holds our hearts. You can write your own Psalm of Lament. That's what poet Anne Weems did when her 21-year-old son was murdered. Here's one of hers. Jesus wept, and in his weeping, he joined himself forever to those who mourn. He stands now throughout all time, this Jesus weeping, with his arms about the weeping ones. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. He stands with the mourners, for his name is God with us. Jesus wept. Blessed are those who weep, for they shall be comforted. Someday. Someday God will wipe the tears from Rachel's eyes. In the godforsaken, obscene quicksand of life, there is a deafening alleluia rising from the souls of those who weep and of those who weep with those who weep. If you watch, you will see the hand of God putting the stars back in their skies one by one. Jesus, the man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, wept in sorrow over the death of his friend Lazarus, as we talked about earlier. Jesus wept over Jerusalem, longing to gather her people in his arms, but they were not willing. The writer of Hebrews says Jesus offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears. If Jesus has come to show us how to be authentically human, then weeping and lamenting is undeniably a part of that. It's faithful and it's important. It's different than our usual way of fixing or understanding, explaining, controlling. We weep, we let it be. And there's a tension here. Yes, Jesus is the man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and he also loved to party. He had no trouble feasting, which is also an important spiritual discipline. Jesus embraced both joy and sorrow. In John, Jesus invites us to abide in his love so our joy can be complete. Hebrews says it was for the joy set before him that Jesus endured the cross. We just come out of Easter celebrating Jesus' death and resurrection. What is resurrection but joy bursting out of sorrow? J.R.R. Tolkien calls the resurrection the greatest eucatastrophe possible and produces that essential emotion, Christian joy, which produces tears because it is qualitatively so like sorrow. Because it comes from those places where joy and sorrow are at one, reconciled, as selfishness and altruism are lost in love. The resurrection is the you catastrophe of the story of incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. At some point in all of my sadness, I began to realize I was hungry and thirsty for joy. I had been actively depriving myself of it with my false beliefs that it's not okay to be happy, and that sadness is somehow more real. But joy was also persistently trying to get my attention, so I began to allow myself to treasure good things. I acknowledged the realness of them and held them to my heart like medicine. I found some inner stubbornness and a willingness to risking being disappointed, being hurt more, being caught laughing. Jesus lived that way, and he calls us to this kind of dangerous living. And I think poet Jack Gilbert captures this call in his poem, A Brief for the Defense. He says, "We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. We must admit there will be music despite everything." So even if the symphonies remain tragically unfinished for now, there still is and there will be music. Joy is present. Joy is real. Just as real and true as sorrow. Befriending both sadness and joy helps us face life and live with our whole hearts. Daring to be happy, risking joy, all we need is a little room, a little crack, a little openness. C.S. Lewis assures us no soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek, find. To those who knock, it is opened. Befriending joy may take some stubbornness and risk. Befriending sadness may take time and space, kindness. In our sadness, can we make room for joy? Can our joy acknowledge and include sadness? The world is filled with reasons to be downcast, but deeper than sorrow thrums the unbroken pulse of God's joy, a joy that will yet have its eternal day. To set our hearts on this joy reminds us that we can choose how we respond to any particular moment. We can search for God in all circumstances or not. We can seek the pulse of hope and celebration because it is God's reality. I'll ask the band to come up as I close here. So my journey has led me toward making more room for joy. Just letting it be real and strong. Strong enough to then include sadness again. Consider where God is inviting you. Is it getting more comfortable with sadness or anger? Noticing shame? Wherever we're at, we're invited to welcome it all, from joy to sadness, to be present with what is, with curious, brave, and open hearts. God be with us on the journey.